famous circle, nobody thought about anything about this magic circle.
Yeah, also form sounds and form images, we didn't even speak about them. Actually, the image is very complex, you know? And there are many things which would be necessary to explain. And if you are not dwelling on it, if you are not doing your homework with the sign, there's no way, no way that you can understand it. And if you dwell on it, you will start discovering everything about consciousness in general. Because this is not a semantic diagram. It's a diagram of consciousness which perceives its objects through the sense, as an object of sense. You can see both objects and something which knows those objects as such. You see two realities of it, consciousness and power, intermingled in this complexity in which we live, creating time, creating space because of this duality, because of this distance of consciousness to itself, the time and space is being created. Does it make sense to you?
Difference in consciousness, difference in consciousness, right, creates time and space.
Yes. Yes. We came to this slowly from the Vedic times of the vision where consciousness created things and how it created. Now we are looking at this diagram, which is the link between two different paradigms, mainly Vedic and that which is post-Vedic, known to us as rational paradigm. Now, what we didn't discuss, it's just by the way, before we start our class, is form sounds and form images. Nobody asked anything about them, but I think this is something to ask about. How come...
Yes. What do you mean? What do you mean by form sounds and form images?
Yes. Well, it's written there what it is meant, actually, on the same page. You can look into that. But what I mean even more, that on the vital level of the speech, there is one formation, and on the vital of the level of the form, there is another formation. These two different formations create two different simultaneously coexisting worlds, overlapping each other in one reality. The meaningful relation of things in the world depends on this correlation. The space, linguistic space in which we think, and the space outside ourselves are correlated. Otherwise, how would we know what is going on outside, inside our mind, if these two spaces were not correlated? In our mind, what is happening if we construct the sentence? The boy is going to the school. The subject is doing something towards the object. What is happening outside in non-linguistic space? The same thing. Something does or moves towards something. This objective space and subjective linguistic space, they have the same reality on the semantic level. Though their formations are different, but their meanings are similar. Does it make sense? Not too much sense.
So maybe it's good sometimes to tell us again what is the semantic level, because it relates to the original level.
Yes, when we overviewed this sign last time, we saw that there are several levels of the meaning. And we are starting with over mental, which corresponds to paravak, mental, which corresponds to pashyanti vak, vital, which corresponds to madhyama, mediator speech, and physical, which is embodied in the manifestation. Manifestation has two different forms. One is the form of the form, another is the form of the word. And whatever you do, we will always have these two. Yes? We will have the meaning of the form, which can be translated in terms of language or the word, and the form as such. Now, this form, if it would not know itself as such, it would not be a table. Well, it's a far-fetching statement. But if you think deeper about it, you will become aware of that, what I want to convey. Sri Aurobindo says that he has a wonderful statement. Yes, we looked into this universal samjnana, yes? What it is, the universal sense. Yes. Why I'm kind of reactivating our beginning of class? Because I want you to deeply understand this diagram. And if we understand it, if something is not clear, please come with questions, comments. If it is understood, we can really move on and we will see the meaningful next unfolding. If we don't see it, we can't really move on. It's so useless to go ahead.
Can you go again in this picture? Yes, the chamber.
Say it again?
Can you go again?
Through this picture.
Can you again the picture which you gave?
Right.
With the chamber, not that one. With the chamber.
This picture.
The
table.
You were explaining something. Then the form of the table can be only if not itself.
As such. Now this word, small word, as such, at the end, is the whole thing. Yes? Not know itself as anything. No. Know itself as a table. Stay as a table. Why should stay? On what ground it stays? Who determined that stability of this form? Who keeps that form in spite of all other resistances, in spite of me pressing on it, putting computer, pushing it? Who really upholds that form? Okay, well, one can say it's a stupid question because atoms themselves, but who really keeps those atoms together on that ground that they would constitute this particular form? One part of consciousness which participated in creation of the table. This is a human creation, yes? The same computer. But there are other parts of consciousness which were there before human consciousness touched it, which belongs to the first creation. And it is also part of consciousness which upholds this table as a material, yes? Which behaves as my consciousness created it, wants it to behave and holds it as I want it to hold it.
This is power.
Yes, it is power. But it was shaped by consciousness, by the word. And it is utilized by the word, by the knowledge of the reality in all its totality and parts, that this part, this particular part, would be very useful in all those other shapes to play that particular role, to uphold, to be flat in surface, and to help us do many other things. Because there is a meaning to uphold, there is meaning to write, there is meaning to put on the table.
But what are objects which are done by nature? There's a stone, there's a plant.
This is
nobody gave a name, nobody gave a shape. We were
discussing this last time. You remember with this difficult, what is the hill? You were asking, what about mountain? And I came to a very subtle and interesting point where the mountain becomes really not the mountain as we know it, but the mountain in consciousness is something, is like a heap of things. And I asked that time, what about mountain of words? Is it possible to have a mountain of words, or a mountain of, I don't know, computers, or cars, or anything else? Yes, it will stay a mountain. So what is mountain? Is it really that sticking out stone from the flat surface? Or it is something more than that? It has a subtle meaning there behind, which that thing resembles in some way to our consciousness. Yes, so, well, and that time you also said that all this is, and I was saying also that it is all allegoric, or it is all metaphoric, yes, the whole nature. Sri Aurobindo says all here in this world are only symbols who represent some reality behind it. We are all symbols in some way to represent some conscious reality behind it. Everything here is only of that symbolic value, of representation of something which is behind it. We are all allegories and metaphors of that one thing which wants to know itself as such in these particular relations. Well, it's very far, very deep definition, philosophical definition, not linguistic. But linguistically speaking, when we spoke about mountain or tree, we referred to mountainness or tree-ness, yes? Or cowness or humanness, something which resembles that particular meaning, not even form. Because forms may differ, but forms will stick to that meaning, and if they fulfill that meaning, they will be resembling that form. It's a strange thing. Yeah? Now, you can have, for example, a tree which gives a shade under which you can hide from the sun, but you can have a tree which gives no shade. Two sticks sticking out. Two branches which are not at all, no leaves, nothing, and it is still a tree. So that tree-ness covers many, many functions which tree in some way in its form may resemble. It is the place where the meaning ends, and it's interesting that this now only I noticed it when I thought that I put over mental, because the skin cannot really truly show that on one level power and knowledge are one. So it's only on the supramental level, somewhere beyond, there is a level where power and knowledge are one and the same. It's only here, on the overmental level, when there is a flashing out of that supramental, and it moves already in a cosmic, huge flashes of meaning, the separation of meaning and form is already taking place. So we can see a bigger picture, but still they have something of their own. I can see that it makes sense to me now, that I didn't make it completely, you know, dissolved into that. It goes somewhere up and up and up and up, wider and wider, wider, until it really covers and becomes one, where the power and consciousness are one. But we can't see it here on this picture. But we see the tendency towards it. And we see the opposite tendency of separating them from the vital, mental vital level into two distinctly different realities.
What makes you say that this comes from the Superman? What goes to the Superman?
Sri Aurobindo. We were reading his quotation last time.
He says, we cannot see it. Yeah.
We see it as such. This is it. This is the supramental on this level. All is supramental. Only it comes to us to be known in this particular form. Otherwise we would not know it. Now Sri Aurobindo speaks about knowledge in interesting terms. He says, I can know only that what I myself am. And I know others only because they are coming closer to my center of knowing myself. So closer they are, more I know them. Farther they are, less I know them. So this is the knowledge by identity, which he calls. There is only one knowledge. There is no other. Either it is me, myself, or I do not know it. So I have to bring it into the field of my consciousness. It's an interesting definition of knowledge. Now again, this particular and very powerful definition of Samjnana, which is essential for all understanding, that the knowledge separates itself from its own workings to take that working back to itself, to know it in apprehensive consciousness, in analytic cognition. Not to know it by identity, but to know it as if it is different to it. And that movement is creating this, what we call Samjnana, the universal sense.
So we have to create the space, or we take concentration of space to Without space, we can observe.
Absolutely. So this is the creation of space and time. This division, which in this sign is visible, the division on two, as if, when knowledge withdraws from its own workings, the consciousness withdraws from the act of creation to take it back into itself. When it withdraws, it makes a gap. The gap is space, and withdrawal itself is time. The power which withdraws, which pulls the space is time, whereas space is the gap between the consciousness which created this object of sense and that object of sense in new relations. That is space. It starts from the over-mental level, the division. The space enters. It's not the space enters. Its consciousness withdraws from its own workings. Well, in this sense you can see that space and time is one phenomenon. They are not two. It's just a different scale by which we measure these two things. It's quite interesting because when we heard yesterday the presentation on Indian art, Kirti, her name is Kirti, was making presentation. She was saying, she was giving us a very interesting anecdote. When the king comes to learn art from the rishi, rishi says, I can teach you the art, but first you will have to learn about space. I can't teach you about visual art before you learn about space. I said, okay, I will learn additional to learn about art. But for that, you have to learn about sound, because you can't learn about space without knowing what sound is. And for that, you have to learn another shastra, musical. So, okay, I will learn musical. But for that, I have to teach you how to sing, the voice. And okay, so all these things, before it comes to the matter, to the material shape as known to us as art, all those other subtle realities have to be learned and understood there. This is similar of that kind. The creation of this Pancha Mahabhutani starts with space and comes down to matter. But through what intermediaries it comes to matter? Through the space, through the friction in space, the wind, yes, the touch, through the fire ignited sight, through the water bringing rasa, the essence of taste, and finally we have matter. So matter, the material form embodiment, presupposes all those other subtle changes before it comes into this final frictionless form, different from consciousness perceiving it, but not really different. Otherwise we would never be able to perceive it as such. There is something in us which knows it already before knowing it. Okay. So these two realities, linguistic and reality which is of objects, of knowledge and power, of consciousness and force, of Brahman and Atman, creates this friction which is known to us as manifestation. Now, in linguistic terms, it is called vachya and vachaka, that which has to be signified, yes, which is signified, and that which is signifying it as such, by which we know that it is that and nothing else. Now we are moving into a very interesting world. And this is the last day today with Vedic, and we will move into post-Vedic literature. And today is the last portion, which is, I think, is essential to understand how the Vedic word was used and why the whole Indian tradition is based on the word. Now, what Sri Aurobindo says, and we read this last time, that the hymn was to the Rishi who composed it a means of spiritual progress for himself and for others. It was a creation to help him to grow spiritually, to protect him, to ignite in him consciousness of different kind. And in this sense, I want to go with you into a very interesting topic, which is called Svadhyaya or Jnana Yajna. It seems the definition of Yajna, Yajna is sacrifice. There are five great sacrifices. Svadhyaya, what we are going to learn today, is called Brahma Yajna. It is distinguished from other kinds of sacrifice. There are five great sacrifices: to gods, ancestors, spirits, to man, and to Brahman. This is according to Brahmanic literature. And the text from Aitareya Brahmana continues, it's saying, when one puts into the fire only fuel, if you put one stick into the fire, actually today we have fire sacrifice presentation in Verite to purify the world and so on and so forth. People are doing real sacrifice from Germany. It's kind of interesting. They think that by, you know, burning the fuel, something will purify. But the text says exactly this. When one puts into the fire only fuel, one stick, it is already Deva Yajna. It is the divine sacrifice. When one offers to the ancestors only water, exclaiming Svadha, it is already Pitriyajna, the sacrifice to the ancestors. When one makes even a little offering from his food to the spirits, then it is already Bhuta Yajna, to the Bhutas. And when one gives food to Brahmins, then it is already a Manushya Yajna. But when one reads for oneself even one verse from Rigveda, Yajurveda, or Samaveda, then Brahma Yajna is performed. It's a definition of Brahma Yajna or Svadhyaya. So what is this Svadhyaya? Learning for oneself. Now, there is an interesting definition in Bhagavad Gita, where it is said, the sacrifice by knowledge is greater than by any material means. It is called Jnana Yajna. For all actions, and in knowledge experience. This is the definition of Krishna. All actions, all karma, sarvam karma khila partha jnane pari samapyate, is ending in the knowledge experience. So whatever is done here with the active body is only to get an experience in the consciousness. And even if you are the most sinful in the world, by the vote of knowledge you can overcome the misfortune of sin. Like a flaming fire burns to ashes all the fuel, the fire of knowledge burns to ashes all the actions. Now, the sacrifice by knowledge, Jnana Yajna, which Sri Krishna speaks so highly about, he calls also Svadhyaya. Svadhyaya Jnana Yajna. Let us examine the Svadhyaya term. Svadhyaya is learning for oneself, reading the text. When we read text, the Gita or Vedas or Savitri, to ourselves, when you sit at home and open and read it to yourself, this is Svadhyaya. It is different from any other preservation of the text, like Kramapatha or Padapatha, where the text was learned by heart in order to transmit it, but not in order to read to oneself, not in order to know it. So the definition was very interesting, because we will see that there is something appearing later in the text, starting from Taittiriya Samhita times, the formula Ya Evam Veda. Here is this formula. One who knows thus. Now the text goes and describes the whole ritual, and at the end it is written, one who knows thus will get all these sacrificial fruits. It is not that the performance of the sacrifice makes sense, but to know it as such makes sense to the consciousness, and the fruit of the sacrifice is achieved. Even Sayana says here, knowing the text as such is the sacrifice. Now, Sayana says, the sacrifice is of three kinds, by bodily action, by word, and by mind. Again, we have these three, will, heart, and mind. Three khandas of the Gita, karma khanda, bhakti khanda, and jnana khanda. There is no discussion how it is done by the word, for it is understood, you have to speak it by the word. But when the reader knows also the meaning, how it is done by of the words, then in the moment of reading them, the mental kind of sacrifice is following automatically. And even if there is no bodily action occurring in the performance, it does not matter at all, says Sayana. Only the one who by prescription was to perform the bodily part of the sacrifice should do it. Otherwise, any other one gains the same fruit of the sacrifice by reciting the text of it. Thus the reader moves towards the union of Agni, Vayu and Aditya. Now, why I'm reading this to you before? Because I want to say that the greatest ritualist Sayana considers the sacrifice to be as the word sacrifice. When you read the word with one part, and with the other part you observe the meaning of the word within yourself, the sacrifice is taking place. Now, if you don't do that, if you read the word but you do not observe the meaning of it, the sacrifice is not taking place. I want to say this to few people who still cherish the idea that maybe reading Vedic mantras without understanding them will lead them to some kind of punya and they will have some merit. No, they will not have any merit. Of course it may bring some peace, some nice vibration in the body, but the meaning of that great text is not observed, is not seen in the consciousness of the reader. So the sacrifice is not taking place. Now, before going into this, I want to also to...
You have some example about sacrifice?
Yes, now we are going into that exactly directly.
Yeah,
let us now have a look into the general structure and principles of the Vedic ritual. What is that? The Aitareya Brahmana depicts the structure of the Vedic ritual, Agnihotra, as consisting of three priests. As we know already, we already looked into that. Hotaradvaryu and Udgatar reciting from Rig Veda, Yajur Veda and Sama Veda. And these three correspond to three regions: earth, air in between, heaven and earth, and heaven, respectively. Rig Veda, Yajur Veda and Sama Veda. The fourth priest is Brahman, who is silent during the performance, observing all the actions. Now, he stands on the western side and he watches what they are doing. And while they are doing everything and reciting all mantras, he says no word. He is silently observing. But he corrects in his mind all the mistakes the priests are making, in case they make a mistake in movement or in the word, in accentuation. He corrects it in his mind, silently. He is doing prayaschitta. Correction. When the performance is over, the dakshina, money, is distributed to the priests, and half of this is given to three priests, Hotara, Dvaryu and Udgatar, and half is given to Brahman alone, who was silent. Now, Aitareya Brahmana disputes and asks, how come he did nothing, he was standing watching, and you distributed half-half? And then explanation follows. These three priests represent speech, whereas Brahman represents mind. The three priests represent earth, and Brahman represents heaven. It is by heaven and earth, father and mother, that the yajna is performed. That's why Vayu Pavamana is yajna. Vayu. Heaven and earth and Vayu. Starting from earth, not reaching heaven. Starting from heaven, not reaching earth. But creating something in between, which is called yajna. The consciousness can enter through that crack, through that hole, and manifest itself in all its varieties, in the mind, in the vital, and in the physical. Now this is the Vedic vision. I'm not going deeper into that. The union of three, and the union of three fires, the fire, the Agni, is the essence of earth, the essence of heaven is Surya, and the essence of space in between is Vayu. The union of three fires, of Agni, Vayu and Surya, is the aim of the sacrifice. Make sense?
Yes.
to me also. So svadhyaya, what is svadhyaya? Svadhyaya, and actually with Kiribhai, I spoke and he said, I know nothing, no other method but svadhyaya. Svadhyaya is something when you read to yourself the text, you know perfectly by heart. Why should you read? Why should Brahmin or anybody, Rishi, read text to himself which he knows perfectly by heart? What's the point? He already knows by heart. No, he has to perform svadhyaya. He has to read it and to understand it anew, with a silent mind to observe the flow of the words, bringing in the meaning in the moment he reads it, creating in him that new space.
Could you accompany others to just have a jump into my mind to written music in Europe? There are many musicians who can perfectly read music, but it doesn't make any sense. They have to read it, even if they know or not, and play it. And to have every time new space.
Yes, it's all comparable. We do not do anything without this device. It's a very interesting thing. Why we are reading books? What is happening to us when we read books? Drama. Why we go to cinema? Why we are going to the theater? What is happening to us when we watch a movie? Why we are crying or laughing? What has happened to me then when Indian movies, you know how they are. Everybody is full of tears, and in Russia especially, when the Indian movie arrives, at the end of the movie you can see everybody is with black makeup. What happened to all these people? They were sitting in front of the screen and they were watching something on the level of the word, perceived it in the mind, and something happened in their vitality. They lived it. They had an experience, high experience of sorrow and laughter and everything else. That's what the theater does to us. The theater, Natya Shastra, describes first performance as a performance done to the gods. Men were making sacrifice, and sacrifice was the first performance of the creation of the world. They were recreating the creation of the world in the symbolic figures for the gods to watch it, to enjoy it, and to participate in it, to bring their consciousness into that performance. Later, the audience changed. Instead of gods, instead of this vertical, so to say, relation, public came in, horizontal relation, but still the exchange is there. They have to see the symbolism and recreate in their mind that particular action, and then something will happen in their feeling. This feeling is so contagious that even those who are on the stage, they also feel it. They become part of that vital exchange. That's why musicians play their music, because they feel this elevation. That's why I am talking it to you now, because we are sharing something of that consciousness, and I am taking from you your perception, and you are taking from me my perception, and we take the perception from this text and from the Vedic text to ourselves and recreate something, some space. This is Yajna. Yajna is going on all the time, on all the levels. We can't do otherwise. That's what I was saying, that by reading Ramayana I had much greater experiences than having in my own life. And it was misunderstood always. They said, how come you kind of freak, you know, reading and crying and laughing. But what is offered by Ramayana text is much more refined experience. It's like much more refined music you can have, yes? You know, I can't play such music when I listen to some master. Yes? I can't. I can recreate some, you know, some bits of it for myself to remember it. But to really have an experience of the master, I have to have a master. And this is the masterpiece, Ramayana, which creates in you the state of consciousness you cannot have by your own life, in your own life. This is the role of literature. What it does to us, it refines our consciousness. Literature. We read these things and they create us. They make us. They make our perceptions. They give us new experience. We are seeking that experience afterwards. We are no more satisfied with something vulgar or less noble than Ramayana's idea. I think this is very crucial. Once this is understood, that on what ground the whole Vedic culture is built and why the word is so important, what it does to us. Once you have that simple glimpse what the word does, you can't lose it. And then we go back to linguistics and we see how it was researched. I am not reading to you the whole text with all the quotations. If you want, you can dwell on them yourself. I just give you a gist of it. Well, there are many interesting stories here of Svadhyaya, what it did to the world, how it recreated, how it made the gods sinless again, and how it made rishis to return to Brahma Loka. It is by Svadhyaya alone that it was done. The sacred verses are in the highest heaven, where all gods abide. He who does not know that, what is he going to do with the sacred speech? Those indeed who know that, they are perfectly united. And later the text says, Yavahirva devataha taha sarvaha Vedavidi Brahmane Vasanti. Vedavidi Brahmane Vasanti. All gods, as they are, live in the Brahman who knows the Vedas. And Sayana comments that they live in man Brahman because of him reciting and understanding the Vedic mantras. Now, this part of understanding Vedic mantras is important. You cannot recite without understanding and create the sacrifice. Questions before we move into the next section? If you have some comments.
I don't really understand Svadhyaya.
Okay.
Maybe you...
I will go one more.
Yeah. You give some example also.
Okay.
Yeah, it's better for me with example.
I have a comment that might help answer that question. It's just from a personal experience that I've had recently. Because my mother has been bedridden and she needed company, I decided I would read to her. And she likes to listen to Savitri. So I thought, okay, I will read. I picked a book that she would like. I thought, okay, the book of the Divine Mother. Because she lives in the ashram. Devotion is her path. So I thought this would be a good book to read to her. So I started to read. Now, I have read it several times before. I know the words really well. I've also dwelt on the meaning. The first reading was a study of it very many, many, many years ago. So, and since then, I've read it many times. But this time, I was reading aloud. And I was reading quite fluently because I had the words. I knew the words. I knew what was coming. I could even tell what was coming next. And so since I didn't have to worry about the deciphering of the words, the meaning was coming much more powerfully to me. It was like sitting, there were revelations happening in my own understanding as I read. And when I finished reading the canto, I thought, wow, I have never quite perceived it like this. Maybe it was the reading aloud, but maybe it was the fact that I no longer had to worry about the words. I know the words well, because I've read them so many times before. But repeating the reading, then, of course, with Savitri, everybody says that. The more you read it, and every time you read it, there is a widening of your own perception and understanding, and you see things you have never seen before.
Yeah.
But maybe it's when you read to your mother, maybe love, you tell in the heart.
Svadhyaya, it's when you read to yourself.
Yeah.
This, what was performed
maybe
here, was a sacrifice, yes, by the word. But it was a performance. Svadhyaya, you read to your intimate self.
Yeah.
You want to know. This is something you can't shift for any performance. You can't make out of it the same thing. If you read Savitri with this wanting to know, and if suppose you don't know words and your reading is not good, doesn't matter, as Mother says, you just read quietly. Let it sink in and it will reveal its meaning to you. Because it was charged with meaning of the Rishi. Now, if you let it go in with understanding of the word, but not the meaning of the word, how what it says, understanding what it says, then it will reveal additional meaning, what it, you cannot read. Does it make sense? That there is some other meaning within that sentence or that word, which grammatically it does not cover. Grammar is for you, for your mind, to silently observe and understand the sentence, but the faculty of the text would be, the function of the text is to bring that consciousness in. More silent and more observing you are, more detached, more powerful it comes in.
I gave you the other day some text. This is what happens to me.
Yeah,
I can read it 1,000 times, and it's always, I have never read that before. There are always revelations behind. And I think this is the same with
Savitri also. Yes, it's the same with many of these texts.
Maybe if you read to yourself, to the divine?
Well, I guess the divine knows that text. But I think it's too ambitious. Divine, I will read to you now. I'm joking.
Because when I play music, I can perform it, and I can play it for myself, but in this moment I play for the divine. When I play for the divine, I have the most benefit.
It's like that sacrifice of Natya Shastra. They performed it for the gods. This is right. If you do a performance, we are talking about Svadhyaya. Now, the difference between performance and Svadhyaya is yes, for yourself is no performance. It's Svadhyaya. But for the other object, whether it is internalized or externalized, there will be a kind of a performance. Because if you are not the divine, and you are playing to the divine, you perform it. There is somebody or something to perceive it. And you want that to perceive it. Either, whether it is public or it is the divine within you.
Okay. Or playing, and I think one of the things that happen when you play to the divine is the time isn't there, because you're in the present moment and the music is coming through you. It's not from your ego, and you're not thinking about anything in front of you, so you're like a line.
All right.
So in that place, it's not a performance, and that's where it resonates. Like
okay.
Side of the performance.
I understand now what you're... The point is there that it is kind of negative against the performance as such, as public watching you and rewarding you with something. You kind of cut off from all those rewards and possible exchanges, and you internalize the music. Yes. But do you see that there are two performances and one Swadhyaya in this case? You don't see that this is also a performance when you are doing it to the divine or to the gods or to other greater creatures, to the Mother in Shirobindu sitting in front of them? Would be similar thing in a case only when you want to know, only when you are engaged, then Swadhyaya takes place. Then this is Brahmayana. Now, it happens, but it might not happen because you will let that flow go as such, emerge as it wants to emerge, and let it be as divine wants it to be. And you don't want to know. You want to be an instrument of sounding. You are not engaged in your own quest to know and to perceive deeper than the meaning.
It's not working like that. You cannot play music.
I think there was an interesting story about one princess from Tibet who wanted to marry, and she pronounced Swayambaram, and all the princes from all over the world came and wanted to marry her. One guy came and said, I have so much money, I will build you a golden palace, and you will live there, eat on gold, sleep on gold. The other guy came and said, I have a very special sacred book from the beginning of time. We will write your name there. It will be forever there. You will always read your name among the greatest. The other guy and the other, everybody came with something to offer. And at the end there was one bard who came and he was singing the song. And as he was singing his song, it's just before, I just remembered it because you said about song. And suddenly everybody started to dance, you know, including the king. They jumped and they forgot about themselves. Then he changed his tune and he started to sing very sad song, and they started to cry, including the king. And then they asked, how do you do that, this magic? And he answered, the song I sing for myself, but it sounds for you. I believe in myself. And then rain is supporting the idea. It's in Buddhistic disputes. When the rain comes after the argument, then the argument is right. No.
So that's why we have
so
less rain.
Yes. It's a good point. And the princess jumped up and she went with this poor bard saying, I want to believe in myself. That was the conclusion. But I sing to myself and my song sounds for you is the formula of the highest kind, of the highest. Yes, we call it the divine. We do not distinguish, we call it to sing to the divine. But basically, truly, we sing it to ourselves. That's why you say it's impossible, and that's very true. But if you internalize divine as different than you and make some kind of religious object of worship, then it happens something else. There will be a performance. So now we have to move into the next topic, which is called the post-Vedic thought. it's a big topic. We are leaving our great and luminous world for something much smaller, but also interesting. The shift would be very interesting. You don't have it yet.
Is this text up on the website?
Yes, it is on the website. So please, if you want to download many texts and to listen to your comments and our discussions again, they are all on the website. Just click there and everything is for you there.
It's wonderful. I missed last week and did that.
And it's very well recorded and edited without noises and so on and so forth. Now, semantic levels of the word and the function of language. We are moving to post-Vedic thought. So modern linguistics, theoretical linguistics, recognizes three levels of meaning. It is interesting just to mention here that the semiotics or semiology comes from the beginning of 20th century, after Saussure created his first general linguistics project, yes, pointing out that there must be something as a science of meaning. He didn't know what it was. He said that it has to appear, and it appeared later, and it was called semiotics. So there are three branches in semiotics: semantics, syntactics, and pragmatics. They are called in a plural as a discipline. And these three levels also constitute branches of semiotics. The pragmatic level of the text, of the meaning, you can imagine, we are using even this word pragmatic. It is indicative of some other reality. So pragmatic level of meaning goes beyond the text itself, aiming at life in its objective context, of which the text is only an indicator. It reflects the most external function of the word and indicates its communicative aspect. We communicate, this is our pragmatism of our word, we are communicating about other things. We are not in the speech. It's not the speech we communicate. It is by speech we are indicating to some other outside reality. Now, communicative aspect is considered to be a major faculty or major function of language. You know it, yeah? In linguistics. The major function of language is communication, which I disagree with, by the way, because it covers pragmatic level only. The syntactic level introduces a meaning of the text itself, in between words, semantics, so to say. How words relate. He goes, yes? She speaks. These relations that she and speaks should speak, as has to be, because the relation between these two words would be on syntactic level of meaning. And thus reflects the structural or grammatical function of each word and the text in general, what we call syntax. How to build up the sentence in a meaningful way. And here we will be, I draw your attention to the syntactic level because it is there where linguistics dwells. Firmly, only there, on syntactic level, on the level of language only, not on the semantic and not on the pragmatic level. So this grammatical function of each word and the text in general, a cognitive aspect of language. The meaning of the sentence, the meaning of the text, is that cognitive aspect. It is not yet communicating something. It is saying in itself something. The word which says in itself something is cognizing some reality. Now, it can be applied and communicate something completely different. That would be the pragmatic level of the meaning. And the last one, the semantic level of the word, is oriented to its origin, etymon, a simple root sound representing its creative potential. However, the creative function of the etymon has not yet been recognized by modern science, which sees the creativity of the word as lying mainly in its communicative function. The semantic itself is not seen in the system of original etymological meanings, but as a relation of the signs with the things they denote. Now here we will see that all the struggle in the post-Vedic thought would be to find the meaning. And to find the meaning is impossible in the structure. Now you will see what Chomsky does and everybody. They are just trying to break through to something, some deeper structure, which would have that original meaning, which we would finally call the meaning. But they can't do it, because structure reveals structure, and it depends on structure. So within that context of structure, they cannot figure out what is really semantic. What is the meaning of the word table? Coming back to that basic thing. What would be the meaning of the word table? And then we go to these guys, and they say that you have to read in the dictionary that it is this thing, flat, with only four legs, and so on and so forth. They describe the form. They describe rupa, but not the meaning of the word. The lexema does not have other meaning than the form of the object, according to modern linguistics. According to Sri Aurobindo, the meaning of the word is in etymon, in the seed sound, in the sound which created the word and revealed that meaning in our linguistic space and created form in manifestation.
And what is the sound of the word?
Good question. What is the sound of table? Can somebody figure out what is the meaning of the word table? Some of linguists here. Just guess. We can guess. We can make mistakes. It's fine. We have the word tabla. Table. Yes?
Yeah.
If you go to Latin. Yeah. Tabla, yes. Also, also something like table, a little bit. Table is tableta. Yes. It's flat. And maybe not completely even flat, but also because S dropped from that, stable, sta, because the original root, if I take words in English, for example, all starting with sta, which is sta root in Sanskrit, to stay, you take all of them, all of them, don't miss one, and you will find that the meaning of stability and steadiness and stupidity and stubbornness and so on and so forth, stool, stable, station, they would all carry that etymological meaning of one root applied into hundreds of contexts.
What about star?
Star is from stri, ri, and it is important because star is from a. And stri is ri is a basic vowel, stri from stirna, yes, Sanskrit word which means to move and to stabilize, to scatter. From here we have stella, constellation, stal. These are stars, yeah. So the etymologically, if you look deeper, you will find the meaning which is stunning. You can understand words. They have their own original source from where they came. They didn't come from nowhere. They are not arbitrary words. They are not only the symbols of outer reality. They had their own deeper reality from where they were generated.
That also correlates to languages like Chinese, Japanese. Now we are in certain language space.
Chinese language is of different origin. It is based on the vision, not on the sound, not on the articulation of the sound. It is based on pictures.
And what is the sound of the mother?
Mother, matri, is a root from root ma, to measure, to create. And tri is a suffix of the doer. From here we have many words like datri, the giver, dhatri, the establisher, the creator, matri, the mother, the creatrix. Actually, mother, matri in Sanskrit, has both feminine and masculine gender, both genders. You have this word in
matri,
mandir,
yeah, matri.
Yes, matri,
yeah,
is mother.
Very matri, yeah.
What do you do if you don't know Sanskrit? How you can come?
This is the problem. And I will tell you, it's a big problem, because if you ask such questions, what is the root of mother, from such people who are linguists, they will say, oh, you know, it's mother most probably, or mad, or moth, or even, you will be surprised that they don't see the suffix of the doer and the root. Because in Sanskrit it's obvious. If you take daughter, daughter, what would you know? Why daughter is daughter? You have to go only to Sanskrit, where it is duhitri. And duhitri from root duh, to milk. It's a milker. Duhitri is the milker of the cow, because the daughter in the family, in Aryan family, was milking the cow. Oh, duhitri. So, we are using daughter, all of us, and nobody even knows what it means. It's only in Sanskrit you can find the meaningful root, which will explain to you the context in which the word was used.
The sound of the Sanskrit is, it gives you knowledge about sound.
Exactly.
It gives you knowledge about the
reality.
Yeah.
About your own reality.
It was that when I am, long time ago, I go to Delhi, I just tend to read in Polish some little poems. So tell me how the Sanskrit. And it's very, very interesting. After that, I try the connotation about Sanskrit and Polish. But now I understand.
Yes.
Now.
Polish, Ukrainian, Russian, you will find so many words. Which we feel. Now, there was a question, how these two realities still correlate? Is there correlation between sound reality and other languages which deviated from that source? Is there still correlation? Yes, I must say. And poets feel that. They come back to it every time, because within this articulation, there is a particular psychological state. If you articulate sounds in this particular way, the psychological state is inevitable. It correlates your meanings. It makes new suggestions. And I can show you in the history how words borrowed from other languages, because of their sound structure, changed their meaning towards that sound structure. They were used little by little towards the meaning of that particular meaning. Knowledge. Gnosis. Jnana. Znać. Znanie. In Russian. Now, if I take all these words...
In the Polish sense, znanie.
Yes. And znajesz. If I figure out in historical development of this word and see how it came to mean jnana, znanie, didn't come from jnana, it came from other source, but it came closer to this jnana root because it demands that particular formation. It's a very subtle influence. There was such an etymologist, Krasuski, who was doing Polish Krasuski, who was doing this etymological studies of Slavic languages. And with this knowledge, he says, znachar, the one who knows how to cure people, znachodity, to come and to discover. So the prefix s with nachodity, to move and to come towards, started to mean the roots jnya in these languages. Though there is such root behind gnosis, and there is such root in Sanskrit jnya, to know. How come? That is the question. There must be somewhere deeper within us the perception which we are not aware of, but which can break through once in a while. That Brahmanaspati's speech, Brahaspati's word, is still living behind. And Indra's structures are covering up that word and involving it in different ways. I'm answering in a very mystic way, still kind of relating to Brahaspati's speech, because from now on we will leave him forever and we will go in a completely different world. So for now, I think we will stop today. Is it time? Yeah, I think it's time.
5:15.
Excellent.
So among the major languages, because there are so many of them, among the major languages which may have escaped that all families since the Sanskrit, you think Chinese is one of them?
Chinese is another one.
Definitely,
yes.
it's another source, I don't know.
Absolutely different.
And any other major language, not going into so many?
Japanese is very different. It's not even the same as Chinese, even though they use the same characters. I don't know the things.
Yes. Japanese is a mixture of two languages. It's a mixture of all Japanese and the influence from Chinese. So obviously the words borrowed from the Chinese are then belonging to the Chinese and we would have to inquire whether the original Japanese before the Chinese influence is on the line of Sanskrit or not. But it's still not
Japanese is the same as Korean. It's a agglutinated type. The same as Tamil,
Turkish,
yes. Hungarian, Finnish. These are all the same types, agglutinated types. And of course, if Sri Aurobindo says that there was one proto language to both of them.
Yes.
That means that Japanese is also from the same source. But it is not as Chinese. Chinese is based completely on different principles. Their phonetic system is completely different. Shanghai and Peking, people, they don't understand each other. Beijing and Shanghai, when they come together, they draw on this, on the sand, because they don't understand. They sound different. They are forced to have one.
Forced to learn the Beijing language.
Yes.
Whole country.
Any other known language which would also have escaped that line, except Chinese or besides Chinese?
Well, there are many other languages, of course, which we may consider to be of different source, which are not based on the articulation.
Yes.
But they are not really verbal languages. Yeah? Mm.
Otherwise, you have to go into such things like African languages.
Even there, I'm not sure. Even there, it's a farther deviation, but in time, but it would be also involving, unless it is based on different principles.
Yes. So that means each language is based on this vocal organism.
Yes. Which is one to all of us, and whatever you do with that, you can't change it. There will be two jaws, one tongue, and the same, you know, nasal cavity. You can do a few things.
But the Sanskrit has limited itself, because if you take the Bushman's language, they do incredible things, including sounds and things, but all this has kind of been dropped. And Sanskrit has limited itself to some whatever pure or clear sound. Or it has not. It doesn't even have a Z and an F, for instance. So
it's interesting to know why certain sounds are not there in Sanskrit.
If you want, we can look into that next time, because this is really an interesting question, very interesting. I can show you that Sanskrit is not dealing with natural capacity to produce sounds. It deals with possibilities there and keeps them in a pure mental state from which it can derive many other languages which are more natural in pronunciation. But because of that unnatural state, so to say, in the mind, it can be safe there. That's why it endured more than 6,000 years. It didn't change, because it has its own system of etymons, and it refers to itself, and it has this pure articulatory device, which is mental, which is not based on the outer sound, but on the inner articulations. All right, so we've ended today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.